Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. For more than 100 years, state fish and wildlife agencies have accepted the job of managing specific species, usually but not exclusively those that are hunted for meat or trapped for fur. Managing in concept involves assessing and improving habitat, monitoring populations, setting seasons and bag limits on animals that can be taken. In short, allowing harvest while maintaining a healthy population. So imagine, you're supposed to manage wolverines, the largest weasel. They inhabit the most rugged, wild mountains in the Northern Hemisphere, have an individual range of up to 240 square miles, and can weigh more than 30 pounds. State and national boundaries mean nothing to them. They go where they please. Your job is to manage them in Montana. Mission impossible? Let's hear what Bob Inman and John Vorey have to say. They work for the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Gentlemen, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground. John, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Minnesota, Brian, and my dad ran a small sporting goods store. And my mom was a housewife as the children were growing up, and then later on she helped dad at the store. So I grew up around hunting and fishing and sporting stuff.
Hunting, fishing, and sporting stuff, like what specifically?
Well, there in Minnesota, mostly ducks, geese, pheasants, deer, those kinds of things. And Dad ran a little sporting goods store, like I said, so guns and archery equipment, that kind of thing.
When you look at those early experiences, what do you think about?
I think I was extremely lucky to grow up in a place like that and in an environment like that where there was people that were talking about wildlife all the time. And it was my dad's love of wildlife that instilled it in myself and my brothers.
Where'd you go to school?
Went to school here in Montana, Bozeman.
How did that happen?
As a family, we vacationed out west here and just enjoyed the west. Wyoming is where we were, but I got to know Montana some, and really liked Montana, and just moved out here shortly after high school.
And college was MSU?
MSU, mm-hmm.
What'd you major in?
Well, biology for the bachelor's and then wildlife management for a master's degree.
And had by that time you had decided on a profession?
Yes. I was originally in school for music, but then later on went for wildlife biology.
Your work with the department is?
I'm the Game Management Bureau Chief here in Helena.
Now, our second guest is Bob Inman, and this is going to test most of our listeners' memory. But, Bob, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
How long since you're on the show?
It's been close to 15 years.
Well, it's good to see you again.
You too.
I remember doing this show down in the Madison Valley, and we were talking about a mammal called a wolverine.
That's right.
What were you doing at that time?
For about 12 years, I focused exclusively on wolverine research. I was fortunate enough, my wife and I led a study of wolverines in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, where we captured almost 40 wolverines, radio tracked them, and documented some of the biology of the species.
Now, when we did that show, where were you in that 12 years?
We were right at the beginning, Brian, I think a couple of years into it.
Before we get into that story, let's go back earlier. Tell us where you grew up and what your folks did.
I grew up in Tennessee and was fortunate that my father was a school teacher, and in the summers he led students on camping trips all over Tennessee and eventually the western United States and western Canada, traveling for a month at a time and camping out the whole way. So I was introduced to primarily the national parks of the western U.S. and Canada, and a lot of hiking and camping and outdoors, and at somewhere along the line decided I was interested in hunting and fishing and ended up pursuing a degree in wildlife management.
And Bob, your title with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is?
I'm the carnivore and fur bearer coordinator for the state.
Any thought from either of you of why the hunting and fishing stuck, why it became something among the choices that a young person has that you decided to pursue?
Well, for me, at some point, I made the decision that if I was going to eat meat, I was going to go through the whole process and take it myself and deal with it myself and put it in the refrigerator. So that was one thing that drew me to learning about wildlife ecology so that I could meet that goal.
John?
Well, in addition to being an avid hunter, my dad also just plain loved wildlife. We would spend Sunday afternoons often just driving around and looking at wildlife and spending time looking at wildlife. And I wouldn't say that my dad and my family liked just hunted species. I mean, it was all the little animals from ground squirrels and raccoons on up to everything. And so we really got an appreciation of wildlife. And all the people that I know that are what I would call a true hunter have that deep and true appreciation for wildlife. And I'm very lucky that I grew up that way.
Let's talk about it just for a second. To non-hunters, I would say, many I've known over time, it seems contradictory to hunt an animal that one says one has deep affection or love for. Seems contradictory on its face. Now, I speak as a hunter. What do you say when you're asked that question?
Well, it certainly does seem contradictory, and I can understand that, kind of the dilemma that a person would go through in their mind. But it is just an appreciation for that animal, and to be able to touch and feel that animal once it's harvested, and then to make the use of it, as Bob just referred to actually that's the meat that my wife and I eat, my family eats, that I grew up eating, to make those kinds of connections, I think connects us not only to each other, to my family, to Bob, to you as fellow hunters, but to that resource.
Let me another question about the people who work for Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, a lot of different backgrounds. Would you say that they commonly have a high level of interest in wildlife, whether or not at hunting it is involved?
Oh, very, very much so. Even folks that are in fisheries or in parks or enforcement, no matter what branch of fish, wildlife, and parks we're talking about, I think almost everybody does. And I'm talking even some of our administrative staff, et cetera.
This show is a little unusual in at least one respect. One of the guests is holding a skull. It has large teeth. I'm not going to suggest that he's threatening me with it, but it's a couple of feet away. Now, what's that skull, Bob?
Well, this is a wolverine skull.
Tell me about it.
Well, you know, one of the classes that we all took in wildlife management required us to learn to identify all the species by their skulls, their dentition, and other features of the skulls. And that helps students learn the different specializations that different animals have. And if you look at this wolverine skull...
I am.
one of the most noticeable things, I've opened the jaws here, and we're looking at the back molars and premolars, which are extremely large compared to the other teeth and even teeth of other species. And another unique feature of the wolverine skull is the fact that the lower jaw is attached or hinged and will not come off.
Most animals, the lower jaw will come off?
Yes, when you're holding a skull. And so both of these features enable the wolverine to crush very strong bones and other material. So they're highly specialized to scavenge and make use of even the marrow in bone and bone itself.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Bob Inman and John Vorey of the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks about wolverines. Now, I'm not an expert on skulls, but that animal has a ridge that runs longitudinally from the front, actually past the rear end of the skull. What is that?
Well, that's interesting that you notice that, because that's another feature on the wolverine skull that's unique. That sagittal crest is what that's called, and it's where the muscle attaches to the top of the skull and also on the other end of the muscle to the jaw. So the wolverine has a very large bone structure to anchor that muscle to and give it more leverage to crush.
When you say crush bones, what are we talking about, John or Bob? What's it crushing bones for? If it's a carnivore, why doesn't it just eat the meat?
Well, wolverines exist in areas where resources are not all that plentiful. So they have to make use of everything they can find, which might include leg bones of elk or moose that could have marrow in them.
And the marrow has nutritional content.
Yes.
There's one other unusual aspect to this interview. is there is a wolverine in the room. Not alive, but looks very much so. At the top of the show, I said it's a weasel, a member of the weasel family, but it doesn't look like a weasel. It's blocky, look, has more of a badger profile, wide head, dark, almost black fur, white around the chest. Big animal and has quite a calm demeanor. The reputation of wolverines, John, is not so calm. So which is the real wolverine?
Well, perhaps appearances would be deceiving in this case. I mean, they can be very nasty animals if they want to be. I mean, they can chase a grizzly bear off of a kill, for example.
Now, I've heard that. Now, I just want people to think about it. This animal weighs 30, 25, 35 pounds. Mm-hmm. A grizzly female might weigh 300 and a big boar, five plus.
Yeah.
You're saying can chase a grizzly bear off its kill.
Yeah, they can. They have a pretty nasty demeanor. When it comes to the scarce resources that Bob was talking about, and they need to get some of those resources, and resources we're talking about meat or carrion, they can certainly do that. And they're well equipped too. Well, this is an animal that is really adapted to the type of country that it lives in. It's got fairly large feet, very big feet for an animal this size, and so it can negotiate across snow very well. I mean, they'll go over the tops of mountain ranges in the middle of winter, no problem. That's just part of their regular daily activity. And they have also the fairly large claws, as you can see, mm-hmm. So they can certainly climb up trees to get anything. In fact, that's one of the ways we'll get into later about how we survey for wolverines. But they can crawl up trees to get whatever might be up a tree. And the fur on them is something that the moisture doesn't stick to, and that's why it had been used in the past for native peoples, for example, used it to line their parka hoods so that the breath wouldn't condense on it. They have a lot of unique features that adapt them to their environment.
I gather because of their gentle temperament or otherwise, they don't run around in packs. Is that fair, Bob?
We have not seen packs. typically, we think that the male and female are together during the breeding season, which is an interesting aspect of wolverines. They're delayed implanters, so their breeding season is in the middle of the summer, and the blastocyst doesn't begin to grow until about January.
I didn't know there were such animals.
Bears are also delayed implanters.
Huh.
So they're giving birth about this time of year, mid to late February, even though the mating season is during summer. And it's not really clear whether the male has any role in parenting or caring for the offspring other than the breeding season.
Now, I know the department, and we're going to be talking about that, spends a lot of time watching wolverines, so I'm surprised to hear you say that we don't know if the male has a role in rearing the young. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, sir.
Why is that we don't know it?
Well, it's something that we don't spend a lot of time watching wolverines, so it's something that with GPS technology in the collars that we can put on wolverines, we're only beginning to learn about and scratch the surface.
John, you look like you want to add something.
Well, what Bob just said is that, you know, we don't spend a lot of time necessarily watching wolverines, and one of the reasons is that wolverine is a fairly rare animal on the landscape.
And what does fairly rare mean?
Well, by that I mean that even if we have healthy populations of wolverine, which we do here in Montana, you don't have a lot of wolverine. It's not like deer or elk on the landscape where there's an awful lot of them. They have very large home ranges, as we discussed early on, and they, especially the males, they try to exclude other wolverines from them, so they're a low-density species on the landscape. So even if you have a lot of wolverines, there's not a lot of wolverines.
I'll try to remember that line. Bob, how many wolverines do we have in Montana, and how do we know it?
We estimate, Brian, that there are about 200 wolverines in Montana, 300 in the lower 48.
Hmm.
And the best way that we've been able to come up with that estimate at this point in time is to measure wolverine numbers in a particular place within their habitat and then extrapolate that out to the rest of the habitat in the state.
When you say the rest of the habitat, you're saying the rest of the habitat that has similar characteristics?
Yes, sir.
and what else? In other words, I'm trying to figure out, as I'm asking these questions, how much do we know?
Well, there's other data on locations of wolverines in various mountain ranges, whether it's come historically from trapping records, snow track surveys, observations by the public, wildlife cameras. So we believe that most of the habitat in the state of Montana is at this point occupied by wolverines and has been for the last several decades. And the best we can do as far as an estimate for the state is to measure the number in a specific place and kind of apply that across the landscape.
Now, Bob, from a layman's standpoint, I hear two things. You're counting in one area actual wolverines, and you're extrapolating from that into what you consider to be quality habitat with a record of use. Let's talk about the first part. How do you count them? You're not, well, you can't see them. You did mention GPS.
We made a specific effort during our research project to come up with a population estimate in the Madison, Gravelly, and Centennial ranges in southwest Montana.
When we talked 15 years ago.
This occurred in 2004 and 5.
Okay.
And to do that, we used what's called a mark recapture technique, which is where you capture animals, equip them with a radio, release them into the wild, and then you come back and you recapture animals, a certain proportion of which are marked with a radio. And you can do some mathematics to estimate the number in an area based on those data. As a secondary method, we also went out and ran transects until we encountered wolverine tracks, and we followed the tracks until we could pick up a DNA sample with hair or scat, which is a secondary form of mark recapture.
Is this approach typical to wolverines only, or is it commonly used? John?
This is a methodology that's used very commonly in wildlife research and wildlife surveys and in fisheries as well. It's been used for a number of years and has a pretty darn good record for being accurate.
Now, when you say pretty darn good record for being accurate, that can mean a lot of things. What does it mean in terms of if you say in this area, we think there are 48 wolverines. So what does that mean in terms of margin of error, as in polling data would say? Or do we know how accurate those estimates are? Is that methodology accepted by independent sources as statistically valid?
Yes, the 95% confidence interval is a standard scientific technique that's calculated around a lot of estimates.
So in the Madison, specifically the Madison I didn't ask you about, when we were interviewing you, what did you end up finding there?
We estimated 15 wolverines in the Madison, Gravelly, and Centennial ranges, and we had 12 of those we knew of with radios and captures, so the estimate said there were 3 out there we didn't know about beforehand.
You mentioned, I think, 200 in Montana, 300 population total in the lower 48. What about Canada and Alaska?
There are probably thousands of wolverines in Canada and Alaska.
And they go over into Siberia, correct?
Yes. Russia and Scandinavia also have wolverines.
In fact, now I remember a book called Demon of the North, which was about a Scandinavian wolverine.
By Krott.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about the wolverine, an extraordinary mammal that inhabits Montana. Now, John, I was told that you guys have a cooperative, cross-jurisdictional cooperative wolverine project. Is it true, and if so, why?
It is true, and it's something that we're very excited about. As to the why, I mean, all of the state agencies involved here have the same mandate that we here in Montana have. We are charged with managing our natural resources, our wildlife resources, to guarantee perpetuity. And so that being said, we have the four states in the four of the lower 48 states, Montana being one, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington, where we know we have wolverine populations that are interested in this project that we're just starting off. Now, Wyoming has a year under its belt. We will be doing the work in Montana and the other two states this coming winter, next winter. But what's exciting about this, Brian, is that we have not only the four states involved, but we also have the U.S. Forest Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service. We have several tribes involved, Confederated Salish and Kootenai, the Eastern Shoshone down in Wyoming, the Northern Arapaho in Wyoming, University of Montana is involved. Outfits called like NFWF, which is the National Fish and Wildlife Federation. There are a lot of partners involved here. Now, this is something that's groundbreaking. We've not done similar things with wildlife in the lower 48 that I know.
All right, let's talk about that. First, why are you doing it?
Because wolverine is a wide-ranging animal. As we discussed a little while ago, you know, the average home range size can be 240, 250 square miles. But when these guys start to go on a little bit of a walkabout, they can go hundreds of miles. It's not unusual at all, and Bob could probably talk about this, but he had wolverines collared in the Gardner area that ended up way down into Wyoming. So these are wide-ranging animals. And if we're talking about surveying for these animals on the scale of landscape that they use, we have to do it at a multi-state scale.
My experience is organizations sometimes have a, let's say, local focus. That's a polite way of saying turf. What kind of attitude have you run into from these different entities? Mind your own business. We know what we're doing. We would love to cooperate, a mixture, what?
You know, one of the things that I've seen here is it really is a cooperative venture. Everybody that I've talked to, we've had several meetings where lots of these folks from the different agencies come together, and everybody is excited about it, and it's really been everybody playing together well in the same sandbox.
Bob, you're on the ground, I gather. Do you work with some of these folks directly?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that's come to light recently with some of the newer research is the understanding that the wolverine population operates at a very large scale across state boundaries, and that therefore all the agencies are in this together, and it behooves everyone to pool resources and answer questions to be able to manage the species better.
Okay, let's break that down. Sometime between today and 15 years ago when you and I talked, people studying wolverines learned something they didn't know.
Yes.
How did they learn they were so wide-ranging, or what else ever led to this realization?
I'll give a couple of examples. One was GPS collar technology. We put the first GPS collar that anyone had ever put on a wolverine on a young male down in Grand Teton National Park. And when we got the collar back, we found out that he had moved from the Tetons down towards Pocatello, Idaho, and back. That was a couple hundred miles in a matter of 2 weeks. And then he stayed in the Tetons for a week, and then he made a little run up to Gardner, Montana, and back in literally 4 days. And then we found him out in the Wind River Range in the middle of Wyoming. And so it really opened our eyes to the ability of these wolverines to move around the landscape.
I can see how GPS gives you technology to track wolverines that you didn't have before, but I'm not clear on what is the point served by this multi-jurisdictional cooperation. What are your goals?
We would like to be able to determine the distribution of wolverine, the current distribution of wolverine in those four states that we mentioned. We have a good idea here in Montana, the other three we don't. If we find out, for example, in Wyoming that there are not wolverine there, that does open up a possibility then for perhaps moving wolverine there. There's a lot of ground to cover before we get there, but things like that. And we can also then determine places where we need to protect corridors for movement back and forth. So that will help there. One thing we haven't mentioned as well is we're taking genetic samples at each of the sites. I wish we had time to go into how the project's laid out, but each of the survey sites will be collecting genetic samples, so we'll be able to tell how connected these populations are one to another.
Let me just get this straight. Using fur samples, you're able from the DNA to tell if these animals are related or the degree to which they're related.
That's true. All these genetic samples that we're taking, Brian, will be archived and will be able to be looked at in 20 years or 50 years or 100 years. So our descendants on out will be able to look at their current situation compared to where we are now.
Let's say you run into a problem. you've got a bottleneck population for some reason. Someone might say, great information, what can you do about it in a practical sense?
If the data were to indicate that major road appears to be a barrier to wolverine movement, then we could work on overpasses or underpasses to facilitate movement of wildlife across that barrier.
Like the ones up near Banff?
Absolutely.
Those work?
Yes.
Any other tangible examples of constructive things you can actually do with the data?
Well, one of the things that we'd be looking at is moving wolverines to historical habitat that's no longer occupied. And we know it's historical habitat from, we've combed through all the records going back 100 years or so. And we know from trapping records and sighting records and shooting records and whatnot that this is where wolverines used to be. And one of the things with this project we're currently engaged in is if we find out there aren't wolverines now, that would open up a place where we could potentially put wolverines in the future.
My understanding is right now there is no trapping of wolverines in Montana, correct?
That's correct.
Now, when you step back and look at this cooperative effort, you've given examples of restoring populations. That means to me you want to increase numbers of wolverines. In your wildest dreams, 50 years from now, what are you going to be able to say to your grandchildren?
I would like to be able to say that we helped restore wolverines into Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, California, places where they currently aren't, but that there is habitat.
What would you say to the same question, Bob?
Well, another thing I'd like to see done is that we've mapped out habitats that wolverines would use to move from one block of public land to another. We've worked with willing landowners to put easements in the right places, to develop a network of habitat that facilitates movement back and forth between mountain ranges, like we know needs to happen.
You've worked hands-on with wolverines for 15 years. Has it changed you in any way as a man?
You know, I feel very privileged to have gotten to work on this particular species, such an interesting and previously not well understood species. So the whole process of going from research and learning things to management and trying to make them use that information to do something on the ground has certainly been a great experience for me. It's a lot easier to talk about what ought to be done than it is to go out and get it done. And so I've grown in that way for sure.
Gentlemen, I very much regret to say we're out of time, and I want to thank you both so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.